Misty and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NAPA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual and our personal stories describe in their own language, from their own point of view, the way they established a relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, our speaker for next week, Chris H. from the Hodgson Group, is going to introduce our speaker from this week.
Hi, I'm Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. I love AA. AA is one of the rare things in life that under-promises and over-delivers, at least in my experience. You know, first it promised to help me get sober. It did that. Then all those amazing things that Benjamin just read, you know, which sound pretty extravagant to me, it delivered on those. It's just totally amazing. And it delivered something else. It delivered this fellowship with all of you wonderful people. And in my case, I got extra lucky. It delivered a really special person into my life and ended up marrying her. That's your speaker tonight. The lovely Linda, and she's got a very interesting story.
I don't know about interesting, but tragic, but it ended up well. I'm Linda, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you. She asked me, came up and she asked me if I brought my own readers. I've never been here before. I'm new to Georgia, and I almost said, because I didn't think this was her question, but because I wanted to say, no, I have contacts in. Thank you for being here tonight. You can have a meeting without me, but I can't have a meeting without you. I need AA meetings to, one of the ingredients to keep me sober. Got me sober, it keeps me sober, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. One of my sponsors, I always used to say that I should have a rubber stamp that says property of Alcoholics Anonymous on it. Everything in my life I have because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not talking about the stuff, although that too. I'm talking about dignity, integrity, the ability to show up when a family show up, the ability to be there for other people, the ability to love. I didn't have any of those things when I died. They're tears of gratitude. Like Chris said, I really over-delivered, and it continues to do so. There was a lot of trauma at a young age for me. It's not why I'm an alcoholic. It's not what makes me an alcoholic. It did, I think, contribute to my feeling not a part of. I'm adopted by my stepfather. There was a lot of death and suicide and abandonment and things. He came along when I was 4 and a half, and then my grandfather killed himself, and he was like my rock. And then my little brother was born, and another little brother was born, and I have great parents. I call my stepfather my father. Great family, and there's no alcoholism in my mother's family. There's no alcoholism in my stepfather's family. I've seen my father drink maybe 3 beers in my entire life, and he didn't even finish them. And I saw my mother sip a martini on New Year's Eve one night, and I watched her because it was very odd. And she made a face, and that was all. She thinks she was just being polite. And then there's me. I am, you know, the book talks about a real alcoholic. My biological father, his mother, he took off when I was an infant, so wasn't any learned behavior. His mother was dead by the age of 34 from alcoholism. Her death certificate doesn't say cause of death alcoholism, but that's what it was. She fell asleep. She passed out with a lit cigarette in bed. The fire killed her. I do believe there's a genetic component in this, you know, so I just always never felt like I fit in or belong, even in my family. And I thought, well, maybe it's because I was adopted, or I don't know, it just, you know, just nothing. I felt like I was always on the outside looking in. In my family, I remember, you know, when we were as a group walking, I was always in the front or in the back. I just never felt a part of, I never felt like I was lovable. and I didn't really care. Then in eighth grade, we went to this little tiny town in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. My father was getting his master's degree, and all the kids in the school, kindergarten through 12th grade, was in one school. They were all in like incubators together, you know, and I came from outside Philly, and I just felt like really, like not, like I belonged there. I mean, there was nothing with them. They were fine. It was me, right? It's that thing I have. And they were talking about drinking and what it does for you, and I thought, wow, that sounds really good. That sounds like it might be a solution for me. There isn't a whole lot to do up there, so that's what they do, drink a lot up there. And I went out one night, and I always say my first drink, I lied, I stole, and I manipulated to get myself out of the house so that I could drink it the way that I wanted to. And there was a lot of that going on my whole life until I got sober. I didn't know, you know, we went out and found somebody to buy liquor for us. And I didn't know how much of this I had to drink to get the desired effect. So I drank the whole pint quickly because I wanted that feeling they were talking about now. And I remember about maybe the next half hour, and the rest of the night was a blur. I don't remember any of it. I do remember them telling me if I kept drinking like that, I was going to feel horrible the next day. I woke up the next day and I felt great. I was like, man, I got this. I thought I found the meaning of life. I really did. And, you know, that was at the age of 10, 12, 13 years old. I was in eighth grade. So there were a lot of my, you know, that's when everything started for me. I have asked my mother when my behavior changed. That was when my behavior changed. Alcohol and outside issues became the most important thing in my life, my reason for living. I didn't care about anything else besides drinking and getting high. I started having problems with my family. You know, they knew what I was up to. They would wait for me to come home, smell my breath. I would get grounded forever, and there were suicide attempts. I'd go up and clean out the medicine cabinet. At the age of 17, I had my first near-death experience because of alcohol. I came home, got in a big fight with my parents because I was drunk, and I went up and took everything in the medicine closet to kill myself. And what happened was I was supposed to go to work in the morning. I worked in a restaurant, and I was supposed to be there at 7 a.m. My mother woke up, and she realized I was still in bed. And she said my face was purple, my lips were blue. What happened was I had aspirated in the middle of the night, so I vomited, but everything didn't come out. It went down my windpipe, and the mixture of all the chemicals and alcohol corroded the tissues, the lining of my breathing, you know, tubes, windpipe, and it had collapsed. The ambulance, they called 911. The ambulance came and got me. I do not remember any of that. I remember waking up in ICU in Michigan, and, you know, it was just, life just went on after I got out, and it was a really weird feeling to go back to school, and everybody knew what had happened, but, you know, everybody just kind of brushed it under the rug. But that was my first near-death experience because of alcohol, and it was a pretty close one. But, you know, it didn't matter. It didn't even faze me. The only thing that fazed me was the fact that I was embarrassed that, you know, when I went to school, people knew what had happened. And my father taught in the same school, and it wasn't until, actually, it was only like, I don't know, 10 years ago when I realized what that must have been like for him. Like, that's how selfish I am. All these years, not even thinking, being a teacher in that school, you know, this small school, knowing what, you know, your daughter's up to, and that she almost died and all this happened, and I didn't even think about what that was like for him. You know, I got into other things because you can't smell other things. So I could sneak them in the house. So that got really bad, and then that became the main focus of my disease. You know, that was very bad. That took me down some really, really dangerous, you know, I'm sure everybody knows, some dangerous roads. And alcohol was always in the picture, though, and because it would help to bring me down, you know, that evening, up and down, trying to find that even spot. By the age of 24, you know, people, I was ending up in emergency rooms and handcuffs and, you know, just really terrible places for a young woman to be by herself. I realized that a woman came down to the emergency room, a social worker, and she gave me one of those brochures, the questions about, you know, do you think you're an alcoholic? And I took the test, and I answered most of them yes. And then when I read the back of it, it said, well, you might have a problem with alcohol. I thought, what do these people know? You know, I'm not an alcoholic. Maybe I have a problem with drugs, but alcohol's not, you know, alcohol didn't take me where Well, it didn't take me where the drugs took me. But by the age 26, I'd been in and out of treatment centers and detoxes and psychiatric hospitals and locked wards and jails and things like that. And then at the age of 26, I just surrendered. And I just, you know, I just couldn't do it anymore. And I went into treatment. And by this time, all the treatment centers around New Jersey, Pennsylvania, that whole area, because I was on public assistance. So there were, you know, they would have, what do they call them, like free beds. And so I would use it for, but I would go in and then I would leave. I would always leave. And so after a while, all these places knew that if you let her in, she was going to leave. So nobody, when I was really ready to get clean and sober, then nobody would let me in because they had, you know, I'd used up all my chips for that. So finally, this one guy who was the director of the treatment center up there, he said, "Lizzie, you call me every day, and I'll see if a bed becomes available." And I was homeless. I didn't have any money, but I found a way to call that man. That was back during payphones. I think they were a quarter at that time. I would find a quarter, and I would go to the payphone, and I'd call and say, "Any beds yet, Al? Any beds yet?" And in about 4 days, he realized I was serious, and he let me in. And I got sober, and I stayed sober. Did whatever they said, got a sponsor, did the steps, went to long-term treatment, ended up working in rehab for 3.5 years as a counselor, went to put myself through college. I mean, my life was just amazing. When I went to college, though, I had stopped going to meetings. I had stopped all those things that I had done to get sober. I had stopped doing because my life, you know, what's that saying? Don't let AA give you a life that takes you away from AA. And that's exactly what happened. AA gave me a life that took me away from AA. And it took a few years, but eventually a few things went down, and I just said, screw it, and I picked up a drink. And every time I drank before, I always went back to the drug dealer, and that's why I knew I couldn't drink. And that's why I stayed sober the first time when I was 26, because I didn't really, really believe I was an alcoholic, but I knew that whenever I drank, I went back to the other things. So when I drank that night, I didn't go back to the other things. So what do you think my disease told me? You got this. So for the next 11 years, I was drunk and in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, functioning, you know, as an alcoholic. And then I tried to get sober, and you know, it's hard having time and coming back. And why it was hard for me was because I thought I knew what I needed to do to get sober. So there was like no humility there, even though I thought there was. You know, this disease is, you know, the longer I'm sober, the more cunning, baffling, and powerful I know that it is. My disease is designed to not be able to see itself. That's why I need you people. I give you permission to call me on my stuff. I give a lot of people permission to call me on my stuff because I don't always see it. I couldn't see, and finally, several things happened during those 11 years. One was I was living in Key West, and I went out one day, and I had quit my job because I got a job at this other restaurant that everybody, it's a great place, it's the best place in Key West. Hard to get a job there, and the owners were yoga students of mine, and they told me, they said, so-and-so's leaving town. I'm like, okay, cool. You know, I'll come fill out an application on Tuesday. And so I quit my job, and it was during season. It was January of 2000. I rode my bike to the restaurant to fill out the application for the new job, and they said she decided not to leave town. I was feeling a little sorry for myself, so I thought I'd just go have a couple glasses of wine. Well, I have a body that's allergic to alcohol. And what that allergy is, I don't break out in hives or rashes or anything like that. What happens, I have this thing called the phenomenon of craving. Once I put alcohol or any mood or mind-altering substance in my system, I have to have more. I'm completely powerless over it. I thought it was just going to be a couple glasses of wine. I hadn't eaten that day. It switched to margaritas, and then the bartender who I knew called me a cab to take me to get me. I hadn't even drank that much. But there were two guys at the bar. I think I was picking a fight with them or something. I don't know if I even know Key West. The Green Parrot Bar, it's like a local bar. It's pretty, you know, it's rough, but it's cool. There's music and stuff. Very few people get kicked out of the Green Parrot. I've been kicked out of the Green Parrot. Put the cops. So the ambulance, the taxi came and picked me up, dropped me at home. I wasn't even that drunk, but I remember this. I was a second floor apartment, and when we moved into that apartment, I said to my boyfriend at the time, I said, well, I hope I never fall down these steps drunk. Well, he was at work. It was like 11 o'clock at night, and I was pulling myself up the stairs with the handrails, so I had that momentum and force, and I got to the top railing, and I missed the railing. So I went flying back. The next thing that hit was my head, my skull, on the steps. I fractured my skull in two spots. I was in a coma. They were pretty sure I was a coma at the bottom of the steps for we don't even know how long. When I woke up, I was like, and I remember this. This is not drunk. I remember this. When I woke up, I tried to get up off the ground, and I couldn't move my arms or legs. I could not move. I knew I needed help. So I tried to yell for help. It was dark. You know, our apartment was in the back. It was all surrounded. I mean, Key West has a lot of foliage to kind of keep it private because there's so many houses and people there. So I was in the back and on the ground, and I was like, oh, my God. Like, you know, so I tried to open my mouth to yell for help, and I couldn't open my mouth, and I couldn't yell. I couldn't talk. My mouth wouldn't move. I mean, I was completely paralyzed from head to toe. I was like, and that sobers you up. And I was like, holy moly, what am I, you know. So I just laid there like this, like making this sound, guttural sound from the back of my throat as loudly as I could. My boyfriend wasn't going to be home from work for several hours. He worked nights in a restaurant as a cook. My neighbor had come out of the house to water his plants because it had been unusually hot for that period of time in Key West to water. He had a beautiful garden. He came out. He couldn't sleep, so he came out to water his garden, and he told me later, he said, at first I thought you were just drunk. It's not that unusual to see somebody drunk on the streets in Key West or somewhere. He said, but then I realized there was really a problem. So he called an ambulance. Ambulance came and got me. I remember none of this. I'm back in a coma now. The next thing that I do, when I was on the ground, I was praying to God. You know those prayers? You all know those prayers. Please. And I meant it. I meant it like I've never meant. I mean, I meant it so many times, but this time I meant it. Get me out of this one. I swear to God, I'll never drink again. When I came to in Key West Hospital, I woke up. I came to. And all the nurses came running over with the clipboards and the pens. They asked me my name. I knew it. My address. I knew it. My social security number. I knew it. And I was thinking, I was talking, and I was like, thank you, God. I swear I'm never going to drink again. Thank you. I was so freaking grateful that I could talk, and I knew while I was saying these things, I knew it was good, that I knew my name. I knew, you know, all that stuff. So they're writing on the clipboards, guess what, I go back into a coma. They didn't have the life support to keep me alive down there, so they put me in a helicopter and they flew me up to Miami, where I was in a coma for 4.5 days with a 99.99% chance of dying. And when I came out of the coma, doctor told me later, he said, you just didn't have a 99% chance of dying. You had a 99.99% chance of dying. You are very lucky to be here. And I was like, oh, thank you. I'll never drink again. And I meant it. I meant it with every single cell in my body. And you know what? I signed myself out of that hospital AMA. Somebody came and picked me up, drove me back down to Key West, and I was never going to drink again. I couldn't even get up and down the steps because, well, from the head injury, I lost my hearing in this ear. I have zero hearing in this ear. I wear hearing aids. They're not regular hearing aids. They do cross. They do sync with the sound waves. But so I can't hear anything, and I lost my balance. I have no balance. I shared in a meeting recently that it took me over three years to learn how to balance. And then after I said that, I was like, I didn't learn how to balance in those 3.5 years. I learned how to catch myself. I catch myself from falling. You know that song, Catch Me Now I'm Falling? So I've learned how to catch myself. I always have bruises on me or something, but from falling, or I don't rollerblade anymore. I can ride a bike again, but I just ran into a tree not too long ago. But I'm so grateful. So grateful. You would think, right, that after all that I would stay sober. But about 10 days later, even though I couldn't leave the apartment, I had alcohol brought to the house, and I was drunk. And within a few months, the ex-boyfriend was coming over and walking the dogs because I could not navigate the steps. I couldn't even navigate the shower. I mean, I was holding on in the shower because, I mean, just closing my eyes, I get dizzy, but trying, you know, rinsing the soap out of my hair. I mean, it was really, and you know, he broke up with me while I was in the coma. He'd been sleeping with another yoga student down in Key West. And it was a mess. I didn't really know anybody in Key West that well. And I was alone, very, very alone. And I was going in and out of AA, trying to get sober, going there, surrendering, and then drinking again. Eventually, I was able to go up and down the steps. There was a little park I lived near, and I would take the dogs over there. I had three dogs. There were these homeless guys that were, you know, drinking out of the paper bags that I kind of knew just from the dogs and the park and whatever. You know, I was chit-chatting with them one day after this, and they told me, they said, you need to go to AA. I did have a moment of clarity. I realized that when the homeless guys in the park drinking out of the paper bags are telling you you need help, it's not a good sign. So, you know, they have great recovery in Key West. I've only gotten to experience it as a visitor. They did a 12-step call on me there one night. A bunch of people came to the apartment and got me, and they took me over to this lady's house. Woke up the next morning, hungover, and she came in to talk to me, and I have no idea what I said, but I remember. We were sitting there talking, I said something, and she looked at me. She gave me a look of disgust and got up and walked away. Now, I don't know what I said, but I think she realized that everything they did was for nothing because I wasn't done drinking yet. You know, I end up handcuffed to gurneys in emergency rooms. I end up hogtied in the back of police cars. I end up in helicopters in comas. I mean, there's only one coma, but the other things have happened more than once. When I drink alcohol, I am another person. It's ugly. And it's not just ugly that I'm drunk and falling all over and being a jerk. Just the selfishness and self-centeredness and, you know, the ugliness of who I am when I drink is just, it's I'm disgusting, really. 5 years went by. I went out to Arizona and moved to West Palm Beach, and I got arrested. And I left, there's a jail that the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office, they call it Gun Club, because it's on Gun Club Road. So when I say Gun Club, I'm talking about the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office. I got out of Gun Club one day, and, you know, they have the taxi sitting there waiting across the little bridge of shame as you're getting, leaving. And a taxi took me home. I went home and I looked in the phone book, and I had phone books back then. I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd never called the AA hotline before. A man answered, and he said, where do you live? And I told him, and he said, well, the Triangle Club's right around the corner. And I said, what's the Triangle Club? And he told me it was a clubhouse. And he said, they have meetings there all the time. They have meetings at 7 o'clock. They have meetings at noon, 3:30, 5:30, 7, 9, you know. Like, okay, I'm going. And I went. I went to a meeting, and then they told me there was a 7 a.m. meeting, and I was that you-know-what crazy. Like, I didn't even have to be drinking to be crazy. As soon as I woke up, it was on. Not even wanting to drink, I was crazy. It was just the, you know, the craziness, insanity, and it was mostly self-deprecating, it was all self-deprecating, negative, terrifying, you know, just really bad, bad neighborhood. And I could not get out of it. And somebody in a meeting the other day said, thinking just leads to more thinking. And that's true. It's like, he said that. I was like, yeah, thinking, that's all I could do was think. And thinking just led to more thinking, and it wasn't good thinking. And they told me they had a 7 a.m. meeting, because, of course, as soon as I woke up, I was thinking. I was still working and everything, but, you know, so they said there's a 7 a.m. meeting. I had to be at work at 8. And I said, okay, I'm going to go to the 7 a.m. meeting. So I went to the 7 a.m. meeting every single day. I'm not a morning person. I never was. But as soon as I woke up, that disease was on. The crazy was on. I couldn't stand it. So I got up early enough to go to a 7 a.m. meeting. I had to be at work at 8. So I left that meeting every morning at 20 to 8. And everybody there knew I was leaving to go to work. And I would go to work, and I would work. At least that would keep me occupied. And then as soon as I got off work at 5, I'd go home. Oh, no, I'd go to a 5:30 meeting. I went to the 5:30 meeting. I'd go home, walk the dogs, get something to eat, and then I'd go back to the Triangle Club for the 8 o'clock meeting. I did that every single day. talk about 90 and 90. It was at least 270 and 90. On Saturdays and Sundays, I went to more meetings. I couldn't stand to be by myself. And what happened as the result of that was that I made all these connections in the rooms with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am innately a disconnected person. That's why I drank, because alcohol gave me the illusion of being connected. And as a human being, I need to be a connected person. I don't think my higher power put me here to be disconnected. So that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to do, is how to connect with other people. And it's really easy to connect with you guys, because you guys get me, and I get you. There's normies out there, I'm still not sure about them, but no, they're wonderful. We just moved here. We have the best neighbors ever. I mean, God really delivered us to the most beautiful place. As a result of going to this 7 o'clock meeting, it was suggested I get a sponsor. So I found this real tough lady who, she was a lawyer, a busy lawyer, and she took an hour out of her week every single Saturday to meet with me. And we sat down, and not this book, this is my second book, but we read this book together, page by page, line by line, paragraph by paragraph. I got to a word, she said, if you don't know the meaning of a word, we're going to look it up. She was very direct. She didn't take any nonsense. And that's one of the reasons why I asked her to sponsor me, because I knew I needed somebody like that. And that's what we did. You know, we got to that fourth step, and I knew I was powerless over alcohol. You know, I mean, hello? Like, I was powerless over alcohol. And she explained to me why my life had become unmanageable. Alcohol helped to manage my life. And it worked for a long time, until it didn't work, and then it became unmanageable. So alcohol no longer worked. My life was unmanageable. Yes, there was a power. I always believed in something greater than myself. I'd had that experience, my first recovery, but I was raised with religion, which was forced down my throat. So I had a big aversion to that, but I knew there was some kind of a creator. I knew there was God. And all this yoga, I was, you know, praying to all these different entities and whatever, but I knew that there was something. So I did turn my life, and I made a decision to turn my life and will over to the care of whatever that was. And I did believe that God, my higher power was, maybe he was going to speak through people, because I never had God come down and say anything to me. When we did I got to the fourth step, and you know, everybody was saying, oh, the fourth step, you know, is scary and all this. And it's like, I couldn't wait to do the fourth step. Like, I wanted to see, because they said that your problems are all of your own making. Like, my sponsor said, that's the best news in the world. I was like, how can that be the best news in the world? She said, because you're the only one that you can change. I can't go to, I'm running around trying to change everybody else. But you know what I've learned since then? I can't even change me. I can't change. The core Linda is a selfish, self-centered alcoholic. The only way that that has been improved upon is by creating an environment within myself where change is possible. And then humbly inviting my higher power in to change me. And when I'm able to get out of the way and invite God in to do that, then I have some hope. But so anyway, so we did the fourth step. I did the fourth step. On the first sheet there, I was writing, and I was like, damn, no wonder I keep ending up in these big piles of doo-doo. I keep doing the same things over and over again. You know, I mean, it was like I wasn't even halfway through it. I kept writing the same things. I mean, that was like so eye-opening. And then there were all kinds of other character defects, you know, but I have my favorites, you know. And then there were my fears, and then there was my sex inventory, and then the people I hurt. Well, I couldn't wait to do the fourth step, because I wanted to write down all these people I was pissed at, you know. Like, but then I ended up seeing, you know, my part in it, which, you know, that's the important part of it. So, but anyway, so then I told my sponsor my fifth step. So when I told my sponsor, when my sponsor and I did my sponsor and I did my fifth step, I thought she was going to go running out of the room with her hair on fire. And I think she was falling asleep during it. I'd look over at her every now and then. She'd be look like she was trying to stay awake. But anyway, when I got done, she goes, is that it? I said, yeah. And she said, oh. And then she shared some of her things with me. And just like the big book says, I felt a part of, again. Such a powerful thing. For a hopeless alcoholic to feel part of. So anyway, so then we went to the sixth step and the seventh step and then the eighth step, and she had me write out everything I was going to do to make amends. She said, now, this isn't necessarily what might happen. She said, I just want you to have a framework. She said, because your higher power is going to bring you opportunities. It might not be what's on this paper. She said, but at least you have a guide. So I took the people I'd hurt from my fourth step and I made that into my eighth step. And she said, you pray about it and see if there's anything, you know, ask God. Is there anybody else that you need to add to that list? So there were a few people I added, and it occurred to me that I wasn't on that list. I'd hurt myself more than anything. So I put myself at the top of that list. And I met with my sponsor. And she had me read my list. I put my name, I was on the first one. She said, what's your name doing on that list? And I said, well, I hurt myself more than anyone. And she goes, she said, Linda, she said, you've been putting yourself at the top of the list your entire life. She said, why don't you take your name off that list? And when you're done making your amends, we'll see where you're at. So I was like, okay. In the process of making my amends, here we go. And, you know, I had done so many horrible things, you know, my addiction, especially during the drug days to my grandmother and my family, my grandmother, who saved my life so many times. God gave me the greatest gift in her passing, though. I helped her pass. Thought I'd be able to forgive myself ever. And I realized in the process of asking other people for forgiveness, it's just like the Lord's Prayer says, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And in the process of doing my amends, that was how I was forgiving myself. Phew, wow. So then after my amends, I'm still making amends. We're going up to Indiana. My parents are 84 and 89 to see how we can help them. I'll never be done making amends. And I'm not doing it because I'm so sorry. I'm doing it because I feel like I've been given this gift of recovery. How many of us get to have this gift? I remember the first time I was saying sober, somebody was saying how if you took a piece of paper for every single person that's an addict or an alcoholic on this planet and you stacked them up, you'd have a pile pretty darn high, right? If you stacked up the paper with people who are in recovery, who died with this disease, not from this disease, you're going to have a little stack. I want to be one of those people, that little stack, because I have this gift, this precious gift of recovery. You know, I'm trying to get my bearings here in Georgia. We moved here in February, moved here from South Florida. There are a lot of treatment centers in South Florida. There are a lot of detoxes in South Florida. There are a lot of halfway houses in South Florida. There's a lot of everything in South Florida. There are meetings, clubhouses on every corner. And it's just not like that where we are. And I'm not saying anything about the AA here. There's just not as much of it. Down there, the treatment, there's a lot of treatment center influence where, like, I shouldn't be saying this was being recorded, but people down there know it. You know, if you work on your issues, you're not going to want to drink anymore, which is not, in my experience, that is not true at all. I've had a lot of outside help, but that's not what keeps me sober. So that message creeps into AA. You hear it every now and then. But here at Solid Alcoholics Anonymous, 12 steps, sponsorship, meetings, sponsors, steps, service, fellowship, meetings. I go to meetings. I get a sponsor. As a result of finding a sponsor, I do the steps. As the result of doing the steps, I get to the 12th step. And probably before that, my sponsor had me doing service. And then a fellowship grew up around me. As the result of connecting with other people, going to all those meetings I said I went to because I was trying to save my butt that was on fire, I connected. And those people that I sat with in those clubhouses when there was nothing to do except us talk about whatever, they became my friends. And they helped save my life. Hopefully I helped them too, but they saved my life. And I'm incredibly grateful. You know, the amends, and then 10, 11, 12, you know, some people call them the maintenance steps. If I maintain in this program, that's not good. I need to grow. I need to continually be growing spiritually. One of my sponsors down there, she relapsed recently. She got a new sponsor and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, I called my sponsor, and I have a male sponsor. I called him because she asked me to sponsor her again from up here. And I called him to see what he thought, and he said, well, you know her well. And you know, she had a couple, 2.5 years, and he said, you can sponsor her. And he said, but you know what she did, didn't you, don't you? And I said, what? And he said, she failed to perfect and enlarge her spiritual work. And you know what next thing that came out of my mouth was to work and self-sacrifice for others. Because it's not just the praying. It's not just meditating. It's not just going to church or whatever I else do that's spiritual. It's work and self-sacrifice for others. One of the guys, Boston, down in Florida, he said, if your AA program isn't causing you some inconvenience, you're probably doing it wrong. Sometimes it's inconvenient, but you know what was really inconvenient? Being in jail. Being in a coma. Being hogtied in the back of a police car. Being alone in Atlantic City down at the beach at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, I mean, just all these crazy, that's very inconvenient. Being, you know, my father telling me not to call anymore because every time you do, your mother ends up in tears. Being a liar, a cheat, and a thief. All those things, not being able to look at myself in the mirror, that's pretty inconvenient too. The gifts of this program are, you know, I was talking about the rubber stamper. One of my girls, she actually bought me a rubber stamper. It says Property of Alcoholics Anonymous on it. Because everything that I have in my life, I owe to this program. It's just exponential. It's like the more that I do in AA, the better. Sandy Beach, I'm a big Sandy Beach fan. I think his greatest ever. I've heard him a lot. He used to come to the Florida State Convention every year. We used to go every year, and I listen to his podcast a lot. But he has one called Everything is Perception. And he spoke that after both of his daughters died. One of them got murdered. He was on some other wavelength. He said that everything is perception. You know, perception is reality. What the steps do, is they did for me, is they changed my perception. I mean, I have a disease of perception. My perception, the way that it was, I couldn't live in my own skin. I needed something to change my perception because I have a disease of perception. So alcohol helped to change my perception. Take away alcohol, guess what? I still have that screwed up perception that I can't be in my own skin. I don't belong. I'm on the outside looking in. Nobody loves me, wants me, blah, blah, all that stuff. But as the result of working these 12 steps and doing what I did when I first got sober continually, I mean, I'm not continually, I mean, not Pat, don't please. I don't do this perfectly. I'm trying to do to the best of my ability and willingness. My perception changed and continues to change, and it needs to continue to change. I need to continue to grow in a spiritual way because, you know, I think that God is love in my book. God is love. You know, I have my disease is selfish, self-centered fear. And if I am allowing fear to control me and make decisions for me, guess what? I'm walking closer to a drink because that's my disease. My disease doesn't want me to do those things that are going to help me grow. It keeps me in fear. It keeps me with a shell around me, with, you know, this suit of armor, like, you know, nobody's going to get me here, you know, but don't take any risks. But when I step beyond my fear, my sponsor always says this. He says, if you really want to achieve what Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer, you have to continually be willing to walk through your fear and make yourself vulnerable in the process. And man, I didn't like that when I heard that, but fear is just this made-up thing that I have in my head about something, how it's going to turn out or what's going to happen or, you know, whatever. When I do that, I've walked beyond my fear. I believe I'm walking away from a drink. So if I allow fear to make decisions for me, I'm walking towards a drink. If I walk through my fear and get to the other side of it, which really I think is an act of love, because I'm doing it because I'm growing. Sometimes I'm doing it because I'm being forced to, or there's no other choice. But if I do choose to step beyond my fear, walk through my fear, guess what? It's like, what's that saying? Fear knocked, faith answered, or nobody was there, faith answered the door. I forget how it goes. But, yeah, we moved here in February, and I was really like, Chris had been working up here for 6 years, commuting back and forth, because we both got sober in Florida. We both had this huge network and community and life down there. But we'd retire there, and then we realized that we really wanted to move here. So we moved here in February, and I was unwell, physical things, but really, like, I came to look at houses, and I don't usually fly, but I flew, and I was so overwhelmed. We had been a long journey. On the plane, I was so overwhelmed. I couldn't watch a movie. I couldn't read a book. I was just like, so I just closed my eyes on the whole flight, and I just prayed and tried to hear the message of God. Like, what, please, like, please help me here. And I kept feeling this thing was like, don't worry, everything's going to be okay. Everything is going to be better than okay. And that's been my experience so far in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not only my own experience, but what I see other people, like thousands of people over the years. You know, when I do what I'm supposed to do in AA, not only does it turn out good, but it turns out better. Beyond, you know, how's it go in the book? Better than anything I could have planned for myself. And so I kept getting that feeling, don't worry, it's going to be okay. And you know what? God brought us to the most amazing neighborhood, to the most amazing house, to the most amazing meetings, people in the rooms of AA. We're just really, really happy to be Georgians now and a part of Alcoholics Anonymous in this community. So thank you for listening.
Thank you, Miss Linda. To be told that you have 99.99% chance of not surviving, and then seeing you up here to tell your story is proof that a higher power exists. And thank you for that. We have asked Melissa to come up and hand out the chips.
Hey, my name is Melissa, and I'm a recovering alcoholic.
Here, just like other meetings, we have a chip system. They don't serve, they just help mark your clean time. Does anybody want to come and walk with us one day at a time? 30 days. 60 days. 90 days. 6 months. 9 months. Year. Multiples. The only.
Hi, alcoholic.
Hey, Bobby.
I haven't found it necessary to use drugs or alcohol since July 7th. Wow. 17 years. When I came in, I had nothing. Not just material-wise, but I didn't know how to deal with people, know how to do anything. Single child, an only child, with a group of a single parent that was alcoholic. So I taught myself a lot of things the wrong way. First couple of years of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was undoing those bad teachings. It's given me a great way of life. Everything that I was looking for with drugs and alcohol, I found in these rooms. And I did it by the same thing I did when I started drinking and drugging. I found someone that knew how to do it, and I emulated what they were. And I got messed up. So when I came in here, I was fortunate enough that, my uncle already had several years. All his friends had several years. So I just kind of watched them, emulated what they were doing, and I stayed sober. It overpromises. Man, does it. This is all I ever wanted. I was telling a sponsee, I said, I've tried to be someone else for far too long. I have the freedom to be me today. And that's all I ever wanted.
The only chip we offer twice is the white chip. Because you're that important. Give yourself a chip on the head.
Thank you, Warner, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Was the last thing I wanted to do. There ain't no denying the pain you put me through. I thought I knew you so well. Guess I have to blame myself for letting you burn me till I was head down, hellbound, digging that hole in my soul. Got tired, wound up. Turned a good girl into a liar. I didn't come here looking for the light. No, no, I came in here running from the fire. Sweet talking heartbreaker, you had me believe that you love me, but you gave me one match and gasoline. It all happened so fast, nothing was left. the light. No, no, I came in here running from the fire. From the fire.